This is CliffCentral.com.
The Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're live with me, Kingsley Kipuri, on the Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. Been away for a couple of weeks. So excited to be back. I've truly missed you guys. Cold front's gone. Weather's feeling good. I'm having the time of my life. So just really excited to be back. Great reception from Twitter. Thank you so much to everybody who listened in to our last interview with Prof. Ola from Wits. Phenomenal book, phenomenal interview, and we're just loving the engagement on that. So all the feedback we're getting, Facebook, Twitter, and on via email. And we really look forward to bringing you much more content like that. So it's a massive thank you from us. I'm trying to think what's been happening since we were last on. We had the eclipse in America. My favorite picture was Donald Trump staring right into it. That was pretty funny. So I had a great time with that. Since then, what have we been thinking about? A lot about democracy. And there's a lot of voting, at least, happening across the continent. So we've had the Rwandese elections in the month of August. We've had the Angolan elections in the month of August and the Kenyan elections too. So we've been doing a lot of thinking as to what's come out of those and what lessons can we learn for those specific countries and for South Africa and the rest of the continent, really. So lots of talking points around incumbent governments and how they can remain neutral or abuse state power in the build up to elections. A lot about opposition politics and when is it just disruption and when is it truly fighting for, you know, electoral policies to be followed and constitutional policies to be followed. Then a lot about true democracy and citizenry, and whether voting is enough to say that everybody was counted and included and that everybody has a voice in how their lives turn out. I'm not in studio alone. Kader Greg Nicholson is also here. How are you doing, sir?
It's good to be back after a little break.
You got the man flu again.
I think I might be allergic to bullshit, I'd say, after reading Duduzane Zuma's letter yesterday. So it's come. I've got a cough and maybe a flu coming on.
Greg's bringing the spice. Oh, man. Wow, that was great. No comeback from me. That was fire. That was power. Power to you, sir. Okay, time to get into it. So first thing we want to talk about is Rwanda. On the 4th of August, that's last month, we had elections in Rwanda, and there's a lot of conversation around Paul Kagame, the current president there, around the trade-off we see coming out of Rwanda about, you know, a lot of allegations around clamping down on freedom of speech and freedom of movement and ideas, but, you know, the trade-off for sort of development and progress and development outcomes. So on the line, we've got Daniel Makokera, who's an analyst who closely watches Rwanda. Daniel, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much.
I'm good. Thanks, Daniel. I know we had to move times around. Thanks for coming on. So, Daniel, my first question is really starting even before the election. When you see the move to allow President Kagame to stand again for a third term and potentially being able to stay in power till 2034, at least hypothetically, is that worrying for you? Is that alarm bells around, you know, an evil dictator staying on, or are you just seeing someone who's doing their job and is being allowed to keep their job?
I think for me, Kingsley, I am not very worried, and I suppose I'll have to justify my statement. If you just look across the continent and you look at countries that have gone through elections over and over, you try also and look at what they've done for their people, I think that's where you start probably seeing why President Kagame seems to be very much liked by people across the board, by the way. I'm thinking the country to our north. They say they go through elections and they'll tell you that they're doing right with the people. But of course, we know that there are a lot of people here who are from Zimbabwe who are running away from a government that says they're doing right. Now, contrast that with what I see in Rwanda, and I have to tell you, I've been following Rwanda for a while now, from the 1990s. And the first time I went to Rwanda, I arrived at a very, really ramshackle airport. I drove on a dirt road, going to a very run-down hotel. You go to Rwanda today, skyscrapers, five-star hotels. You have kids who are going to school and they're using tablets, even in the furthest of the rural areas that you can go to. You have a parliament that is a shining example, not only for the continent, but also for the world, where more women representatives, actually we have the biggest percentage of women representatives in that parliament. Right now, the chief of staff, just to tell you something, interesting. Chief of staff in President Kagame's office is under 40, the chief of staff of the president of Rwanda. And roads are being built, people are going to school, more and more people, you're getting to see people coming back. And the sense you get is it's a people that is happy with what is going on in the country. Now, you will know the background of Rwanda, what happened in 1994, where there was the extremist Hutu people who went on for the minority Tutsi people. Today, the biggest supporters of President Kagame are not the minority Tutsi people. It's actually mainly the Hutus who say, we were told by the extremists that if Kagame and his people were to come back, they were going to chase us back into the bushes of Congo. But today we are here, home, happy, and rebuilding the country. That's what you get to hear. Now, is it a perfect society? Is it a perfect government? I would say, like most governments around the world, no.
I mean, I hear you, and the development indicators are there, right? So the work on poverty is great in terms of the number of people who no longer have to live in poverty, in terms of mortality rates, in terms of gender representation, in terms of education levels. So the numbers are there, but are you not concerned about the things that don't make it to the press, the things that don't come out in terms of ability to criticize the state, ability to criticize the government, ability to express yourself freely? What's your take on the trade-offs that are having to be made for this pace of development and amount of discipline towards the development?
You know, Kingsley, for me, and probably you might end up calling me a Kagame apologist. I suppose I'm a bit sold to the Rwanda story because I saw the trajectory of the country from ground zero to where it is now. But
with that, you can critically engage with trade-offs, despite...
That's what I want to do, but I want you and I to also be very open. I'm a journalist myself, so maybe not practicing as much as I used to do, but I just want to... Let's have this discussion.
Sure.
Singapore, many people will tell you it's not a democracy, right? But if you go to Singapore, actually they call Singapore City the fine city, not because of sunshine. If you spit, you get fined. If your dog pees on the pavement, you get fined. If you just don't do certain things in Singapore, right? But I think maybe time has come for me as a journalist, as an African journalist, where we should stop parroting certain things that we hear. I just wanna challenge you on the questioning you asked me. You say, Daniel, but are you not concerned about things that are not coming out? I don't even know what those things are personally.
Okay.
So now I must be concerned about things that are not coming out. But
you don't know about Kagame and enemies in quotes getting killed in Sandton hotels and his work in the DRC and involvement there. You know nothing of this.
No, I'm not saying I know nothing.
Okay. So we know the trade-offs. I'm not saying we must, that's the whole story. I'm just curious as to how you balance those out in terms of saying Kagame's bet is that we don't have the luxury of some of these things, right? We've come from a dark past. We've got to catch up and we can't afford to slide back into genocide and civil war. And there've been certain trade-offs. So I just want to discuss the trade-offs.
For me, Kingsley, my argument would be there's a tendency, especially from outside, to see Africa as a village and a one-size-fits-all.
Okay.
I think the background of countries must be taken into consideration. If you were to take South Africa, for example,
sure.
I mean, talk just about race relations in this country. At times, someone posts something on Facebook, and then the whole city goes alive. Now, are we saying that we are not in a democracy? No, we are in a democracy. But are we saying that because apartheid is no longer on the statute books, everything is all hunky-dory? No, it's not. So there is a process to go through. But should we judge then our leadership that they failed the majority of the Africans in South Africa for not advancing the issues of race relations? No, I don't think so. I think it's work in progress. That's how I view the issue of Rwanda. And, you know, at times I get the sense it's almost like, let's wait. I mean, this thing is too good to be true. What is it that we should wait and see whether something gotta give very soon? That's what I hear. The narrative on Rwanda is quite interesting for me.
Okay. And Daniel, I'm curious to your thoughts around some of the, if we look at Rwanda as a project and some of the strategic bets being made, focusing on tourism, and you've seen that through the airline, you've seen that through the connectivity, focusing on ease of doing business, focusing on renewable energy and things like cargo to deliver drones. And I'm curious about your take about some of the strategic bets that they're making, that when we, if we invest in these specific things, the next 10, 20 years, we're building the economy of the future. What's your take on some of the decisions being made policy?
My take is watch this space when it comes to Rwanda. It's a people that is committed, they are driven. It's a people that knows that they don't have much as far as their country has to offer with natural resources. Though I'm beginning to hear noise that there might be some minerals that might have been discovered, but of course is something that really has not been out there. I think they've modeled themselves and saying the most important resource we have is us as human beings, human resource. So what do we do? Then I think the leadership has looked at it and say, well, then let's be calm. Let's make sure that our resource is very much educated. Let's make sure that we make Rwanda a destination for many things. Right now, Rwanda is the conference's, Kigali is the conference's capital of our continent. Any conference here is in Kigali. I think they are looking long-term. They have a long-term vision, and they see themselves as probably the springboard into the rest of East Africa. And they are building institutions, and that's another thing I wanted to say. They're building institutions that would outlive this current leadership. And you're getting young people who are coming back from all sorts of countries, coming back to rebuild Rwanda, which, by the way, you could be in a taxi. You have Wi-Fi. Most schools are fully Wi-Fi. So they've taken the issue of innovation, the issue of the digital advancement to heart, and they are capitalizing on it.
Daniel, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us. It's a country we continue to watch with, you know, with great anticipation to see how things come together. Thanks for the insights, Daniel.
Welcome,
Kim. Okay, wonderful. Thank you. Greg, before we just move on, I just want to talk about one thing. We discussed before our cadres, a former cadre, Simon Allison's article about the trade-off between development and some of the freedoms that we'd like to see in democracies. And you made a great point about it's... I'll let you make your point for yourself, but, you know, go ahead.
I think what we're talking about is... Simon was writing about how what we now call the Rwanda model is often looked at around the continent as a model that can actually lead to development. That's what we've seen in Rwanda, rapid development, but obviously, like you're saying, it comes at the cost of human rights. And so one of the points that Simon made, and some of those human rights, like you mentioned, is curtailment of freedom of speech, no free press, basically no opposition. I think there was only one person that ran against an opposition member in the recent elections.
And the election result was 98.7%.
Yeah, as well as jailings of poor people and street people. And the list goes on and on and on. And like you mentioned, political assassinations, the list goes on. But I think what Simon was trying to say was that it's easy to achieve the oppressive aspects of such a regime. Yeah. It's not easy to achieve the aspects of development. So, and in Rwanda, it's actually quite complicated how they've led to this sort of rapid development. It's not just cut down on freedoms and your country will improve. That's not exactly how it works. They've got all sorts of other systems of accountability in place to ensure that they develop at a rapid pace. And I think if we are to expand this model of this trade-off of curtailing freedoms while trying to push development, it's not a given that equation will necessarily lead to development, but it is a given because it's meant to, that it will cut down on freedoms, because that's the easy part.
Absolutely, and you got to do the discipline part right of saying, now that you're trying to focus everyone in one direction, you need the indicators. There's a lot of work, there's a lot of cool writings about Rwanda Inc. and how it's run in a corporate-esque fashion, just in terms of the indicators that everybody knows exactly what a good indicator is for their job and is trying to achieve those and exceed those. So when you're creating that discipline and focus, you got to then do something with it. You got to convince people to take pay cuts to move back home and work for the state. And the under 40 chief of staff who Daniel was talking about, I have no doubt that's Ivy League and so on. So you got to do the other pieces. Anyway, thank you for that. I think we got to transition to a different country, if I'm not mistaken. So Palesa and Greg will tell us what...
Yeah, we're good to go. Oh, so we're going to go to Kenya right now.
Okay, perfect. So next up, we're going to be talking about the Kenyan elections recently concluded. We'll be speaking to Nanjala Nyabola, who's a fantastic writer and thinker on all matters Kenyan, politics, democracy, justice. So what we're going to just be talking about regarding Kenya is really the recently concluded elections. So, I mean, this has been covered quite widely in South Africa, but we have... current president Uhuru Kenyatta and his Jubilee party going up against Raila Odinga, who formed a coalition called the NASA coalition, the National Super Alliance, and I think the narratives have been discussed in terms of we have what a lot of people perceive to be what's been a Kikuyu dominance on the tribe, the Kikuyu, in terms of the current president, his father's, a lot of people see as the founding father of the country, Uhuru Kenyatta, was very well known, and being able to form their Jubilee party or Jubilee alliance. So just to continue, so basically in the run up to elections, what you have is a really, you know, a lot of people might say disenchanted Kenya going to the elections in terms of the delivery record. So you have a Jubilee party that really has failed on the corruption front in terms of policing corruption, where a lot of people are seeing every week feels like a scandal. And this might sound familiar to those listening from South Africa, where it feels like every week, every month, there's another massive corruption scandal. So we're coming in with that. At the same time, we have some things that have been delivered on, like the massive railway from Mombasa to Nairobi that has really been hailed as a big win in terms of imports, exports, and so on. And then lastly, we have to remember that we had the great rallying of the president and his deputy, William Ruto, when they were supposed to be tried at the ICC and had to sit at the ICC for alleged crimes against humanity in the post-election violence of the 2007 election. So you have this narrative that they've built of, we are the victims, people are coming for us going into the last election. And then the other day we went to vote. Greg, I know you've been watching this and have a bunch of questions about the Kenyan front. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I think the vote almost seemed predictable, right? So Raila Odinga, the opposition leader, yeah, is the continual, you know, opposition candidate. Yeah. Every time we think it might be his time. Yeah. But, you know, and sort of by and large, it actually, the outcome actually seemed quite predictable that the current incumbent president Kenyatta would win, and the results might be disputed. Well, it seems, I'm not sure, maybe I'm being pessimistic back then, but in retrospect, that's how it felt. And it sort of feels like, why does this keep on happening in Kenya, and how does it make you feel?
I think there's a divided, and I'm finding it interesting that you said that the result was a given. There seems to be a divided country, with everybody almost certain that victory is ours and that we are the rightful candidates and we've done all the right things. So there was certainly a feeling from a lot of people that the time had come, in quotes. But as they say in politics, you don't win because it's your turn, right? And we saw with Hillary Clinton also, you don't win because you've waited in line and now it's your turn. So for probably the fourth, fifth election in a row, we have the elections being contested, they've gone to the Supreme Court, and the core contention is the disconnect between the polling results that we announced at a local level, at different constituencies and polling centers, and the national results that were announced. And when we talk about Angola, at some point we'll come up with a similar, you know, the issue is similar. So you have separate polling stations that they announce results, right? They count and they announce. And they say, Greg got 5 votes, Kingsley got 3. And so on. And you had national results that were announced, and there were many discrepancies between the national announcements and the local polling station announcements, right? So in theory, you just need people sitting down with an Excel spreadsheet, just tallying. So that's gone to the Supreme Court, and that's being heard now. And what's coming out is a lot of irregularities with the IEBC. Greg, I want to see if the third time's the charm on trying to reach Nanjala. Nanjala, can you hear us?
I can hear you. Hi, how
wonderful.
Are you?
Wonderful. Third time's the charm. Thanks so much for connecting with us. I know we had to sort of rush the connection a bit.
It's Murphy's Law.
Okay, perfect. So now that we're here, Nanjala, I've been doing a half-assed job of explaining the Kenyan elections. You are a thinker, you are a writer, you follow this so closely and help us make sense of things. And I just love to get a sense of where you were standing coming into this election, when with all the conversations around the IEBC and their independence and their systems and infrastructure, with this feeling that it was Raila and NASA's last chance to win this, with Jubilee's track record and a lot of questions around that. What is your sense coming into this election?
I think there was two things that were happening at the same time. You're absolutely right. On one hand, you do have this sense for the opposition that it was a do or die kind of fight, that they absolutely had to. This is Raila's last chance. He's 72 years old. He's not coming back for another election after this. So there was that sense, at least from the political side, that this was a big deal.
Yeah.
But also in a more general sense, there was this feeling that we have spent, Kenya has invested so much time and money into the election process. I don't know if you saw the statistics. This is going to be the most expensive election in African history. And there was also the sense of, you know, is it Kenya ready after 25 years of multi-party democracy? Is it time for us to actually mature as a democracy and to have a free, fair, transparent election that we can hold up and be an example in the region? East Africa is a tough neighborhood, as you know, and Tanzania is the only other country that has had regular changes of government through elections. So in some ways, it was a test for the process of democracy in East Africa altogether. And when you look at it from that bigger picture sense of things, it's not necessarily clear that we passed the test. There's still a lot of question marks, which is why we're in court this week. But overall, it was definitely a high-stakes race.
And now, I mean, you've mentioned already that the election, I spoke a bit about this before you came on, basically there's major discrepancies between the national results that are being announced and what's came out of polling stations, and that's revealed a lot of irregularities with the electoral, you know, commission's processes. I mean, I feel like there's two things happening. One is the trial of systems and infrastructure and IT, and that's you know, that can have a yes or no answer. But there's also this, and you've written so beautifully about this, a lot of people who want to feel like their vote counts and that they're included. Could you speak more about this idea that people wanting to feel like they are part of deciding what happens with their country?
Absolutely. You've hit the nail on the head. That's exactly the sentiments that we're dealing with. I mean, the litigation is being brought about for technical issues. They're asking, you know, why didn't the ballot paper from polling station X count, and why didn't the presiding officer from polling station Y sign the form? But really underneath all that is this broader question. Does voting matter? Yeah. Does it matter that we wake up early in the morning on August 8th and stand in line for 7 or 8 hours and cast the ballot when we hand over those ballots to the Electoral Commission, there's no transparency as to what happens next? It should have been a very straightforward process. It literally is addition. It is literally, you take one person's vote and the next person's vote and you add them up and you keep adding until you get all 15 million votes added up. But instead, what we're seeing is a lot of uncertainty as to, as you mentioned, the ICT system. Did it work the way it was supposed to work? Did everybody's vote count? Did it matter that we stood in the sun for 3, 4, 5, some even 7 hours? Or was the decision predetermined electronically? And I think for a young democracy, I mean, at some point we're going to have to stop claiming to be a young democracy. You know, 25 years is a long time to have been voting, and we should really be better at this by now. But for a young democracy with a young population, I think 51% of voters in Kenya were below the age of 35. You want people to believe in the process, and you want them to believe that their vote counts. And I'm not sure that with all of the system failures that we've seen, that we've inspired a new generation of voters.
Nanjala, I want to speak a bit about the Supreme Court. I'd love to get your sense on their ability to be impartial and fair when there's, I can imagine, huge pressure to either go with, you know, with the incumbent, or either to succumb to a lot of angry people who feel like their votes didn't count. So I'd like to hear what you think about the impartiality. And secondly, about this either real or theoretical trade-off to just let sleeping dogs lie and just go with whatever. If we say the guy won, let's just get on with it versus opening a can of worms and re-voting.
Let's get on with the business of being a democracy.
Exactly.
No, I mean, it's hard to tell. We've had a new Chief Justice, so the former Chief Justice who decided. This is the fourth election petition in Kenya's multi-party history. So we had one in 92, we had one in 97, we had one in 2013, and we have one this year. And of course, then we had the big case with the ICC in 2007.
Yeah. Yeah.
And since 2013, this is a new Chief Justice. Two of the judges on the bench have changed. So it's much harder to tell. I've been watching the proceedings and following the proceedings of the Supreme Court, and I can say that Justice Moraga is a very no-nonsense kind of guy.
Okay.
If he thinks that a lawyer is telling him something that's untrue, he calls him out on it in open court. And, you know, for a judge to do that at the Supreme Court is something that's really interesting to see. We don't see that very often in Kenya. I think that, you know, it's hard. I think historically we've only seen globally. I crowdsourced this information, and we found only six presidential election results have ever been overturned in history.
Wow.
That's really small, like 0.001% of all the elections that have been held globally. So I think the odds of a Supreme Court saying these results are null and therefore let's go back to the ballot are extremely small.
Okay.
That doesn't mean that the process isn't useful, though. I think it's useful to lay out all those technical errors that we've been talking about, all those shortcomings, so that we do inspire the next generation of voters, so that people can see that, you know, this is where the system went wrong, this is why there's so many questions about the system, and this is how we can do better next time. So really, in terms of measuring the impact of the litigation, I think it has to be bigger than just you know, running the election again. I think we need to really dissect this election, because there are just way more questions than there are answers.
And I'm curious on your thoughts about the bigger question of inclusion. I mean, regardless of what happens with the Supreme Court, we're going to have a very divided country of somebody feeling robbed, and somebody, you know, overjoyed that our team has won, in quotes. And what, and I know this is the eternal question, but what's your sense of how we start, you know, trying to fix that and move towards a more united country? Or perhaps am I being too idealistic, and maybe this is just how it works? Somebody wins, somebody loses, and you get on with it.
No, I think it's a genuine concern. I think that a lot of Kenyans don't realize how much damage has been done to the national fiber in the last 2 weeks. I mean, the days after the election, I was in a couple of informal settlements, and you know, what happened after the result was announced was that there was some attempted protest in different parts of the country, and the police just kind of clamped down with a great deal of force, a disproportionate use of force. And you know, Kenya has always had a problem with police violence. So in many ways, it was a continuation of the police violence that we've had in the past. But now there's this sense amongst poor people and poor people of a certain ethnic background that they're being targeted by the police. And that's a very dangerous sentiment, because it's not a sentiment that you can take to court and say, no, in fact, it wasn't. You know, you can't adjudicate over that, the way people feel. You can only make people feel better about a situation. Mm. I think it's Maya Angelou who says, people might not remember what you say, but they will remember how you made them feel. And to me, the big risk of everything that's happened in the last few weeks is that we've made a huge part of the population feel secondary and unwelcome, and especially poor people in informal settlements. And I, as a Kenyan, I worry about what spiraled from that sentiment. You know, as I mentioned before, we're in a tough neighborhood. We have examples of that kind of tension spiraling out of control all around us: Rwanda, Burundi, Ethiopia, Somalia, South Sudan, Sudan. It's a much easier sentiment to unleash than it is to rein in. So I think that there has to be more than rhetoric. I think there has to be a genuine effort at reaching across different divides, socioeconomic, ethnic, and really working hard to make people feel welcome again, because I think people are really angry. I know poor people in Nairobi especially, and people of certain backgrounds in different cities are really angry and really hurt. And I think it's going to take more than just words to heal that. I think we have to see a new approach to government from this administration moving into their second term. I think they're going to have to make a really concerted effort to bring people back together again.
Okay, and Angela, my final question before I let you go is is how do we move away from this place where, you know, party politics is just is the center of everything, and where the country stops anytime we have anything to do with elections, and this anxiety and feeling that we can only move on, you know, 3 months after the elections, and where everything is designed around the election cycle, and all any development or progress in any community is linked to the individual. How do we normalize this process, or is this a young democracy thing?
Hey man, if I had the answer to that, I would be a million.
I suspect halfway through the question, I was like, maybe we should just let that one go.
I think we have to. I mean, to me, I see two ways forward. One is there has to be a generational shift, and there has to be a new generation that thinks about its identity and belonging differently. And in some ways, you're already seeing that, especially in urban areas. You're seeing a lot of Kenyans who are less strongly identifying with their ethnic groups and less linking their political choices to their ethnic affiliations. I think on one hand, that's one change that has to happen. I think this generation of politicians, we just have to let them go. They seem to be reluctant to change, and they seem to be willing to drag the rest of the country down with them. So I think the whole generation of politicians just has to change. I think that we need to have an honest conversation. I think, you know, the problem we have in Kenya is a lot of the information that we have about ourselves is filtered through a very imperfect education system. And I think that if we start honestly teaching our children about who they are and their ethnic identity, and the fact that it doesn't have to be a threat to someone else, I think we'll start to see some changes there.
Okay. Nanyala, thank you so much for chatting to us. That was really excellent, and I hope we get to speak again in the future.
Thank you so much. Okay. I hope to speak to you guys soon, too.
Perfect. Wonderful. That's Nanyala Nyabola, who's a writer and journalist coming out of East Africa with some really excellent work on Kenya. We're just going into the final portion of the show, and another election, I know Greg has been watching this quite closely, is Angola. We've had a sitting president there for almost 40 years. That's President Dos Santos. And then the shock news that he was willing to not be the president anymore. Greg, what's the first thing you thought when you see things like that happening?
Well, the first thing I thought was that we should speak to our friend Rafael in Angola. So Rafael...
Rafael Marques de Moraes runs a watchdog organization out of Luanda called Maka Angola. We've had him on the show. We've had some really excellent interviews with him, and we've been unable to reach him now just for technology issues between Joburg and Luanda.
But I think the question is, I think a lot of people and a lot of our listeners would probably know that José Eduardo dos Santos ruled Angola from 1979. He was the country's second president and was a minister for a few years after it got its independence from Portugal. And he really led the party, the MPLA, the ruling party in Angola, from being a very Marxist-orientated organization through an extremely bitterly fought civil war until I think it was 2002, and then up until today where Angola has sort of ridden largely on oil money, and it sort of competes with Nigeria as the biggest oil producer in the continent. And going from that Marxist sort of party and structure, they've really sort of pushed this state crony capitalist sort of market-driven approach. Absolutely. But unlike we're talking about Rwanda earlier, not much of that, maybe it's the mineral resources curse that we often talk of, not much of that money has filtered down beyond the elites to the general population, and much of it is said to have been rampantly looted.
I mean, absolutely, and you see that from the wealth of the army generals, you know, the president's daughter, one of the richest people on the continent. A lot of that money ends up in Portugal, and there's a lot of questions to be asked about Portugal's bystanding of the looting of Angola. So I think there's been a lot of disappointment from sort of the MPLA regime and over the past 40 years.
And I think with the over the last few years, the bottoming out or the dropping of the oil price, it's put Angola's sort of economic position in a very difficult spot. So when we're looking at the election and you see this guy who's been there forever decide to step aside, obviously the big question is, will there be change? Will there be sort of a cleaning out of the government, cutting down on cut back on corruption and opening transparency? It's hard to say at this stage, and hopefully we can get Raphael in perhaps next week or the week after that, but just as a bit of a primer for when we have that conversation. So, and I'm going to savage this name. I'm not the best with my Portuguese pronunciations, but João Lourenço was elected president to follow on. He was chosen as Dos Santos' successor. Yeah. He was the former defense minister. And he's come in on a sort of agenda saying we're gonna cut down on corruption, we're gonna be a bit more transparent. But when the corruption comes from his former boss and longtime comrade, you have to ask whether that's actually gonna happen. Yep. So before Dos Santos left, the parliament over there changed the legislation to make sure the new president couldn't change key sort of heads, so like key army heads and things like that, for 8 years. They gave Dos Santos, I think it's sort of an emeritus president position, where he is now, he can't face criminal charges. He's also still head of, Dos Santos is still head of the MPLA, the ruling party over there. Mm. And his family and their allies have amassed huge amounts of wealth and huge controlling networks of the country. So, for example, Isabel Dos Santos runs the national oil company.
Yeah, and any multinationals coming into Luanda and Angola, you need to have a partner, and that's often somebody who's part of
it. It's often Isabel herself.
I'm going to say part of the family, no, it's just Isabel.
But then and her son, Dos Santos' son, is in charge of the Sovereign Wealth Fund. Mm. So there are all these sort of limiting factors that may prevent sort of changing of the past. But hopefully we can ask someone with a bit more knowledge soon as to whether perhaps some of these concessions that were made were necessary just to move on from the Dos Santos era and start to try and bring in another era.
Absolutely, and something we chatted about briefly, and we'll speak to Raphael when the time comes, is just this. I'm curious about this as a case study or as a model for people who've been in power for far too long, and have done some heinous things in their time. But and the trade-off between saying you will not be charged, you won't go to the ICC, you won't end up in a local prison, your army general stay in power for a few couple more years, and then can that then lead to a transition into something more resembling democracy and an inclusive sort of governing style? So I'm thinking of a Robert Mugabe or a Kabila, and saying part of the reason that people can't leave is because you've done too much. When you've been, there's too many bodies buried and too much money stolen, you can't leave without some assurances, right? So I'm curious, and we probably only know this in 10 years or so, when the generals are no longer protected and can leave, and we'll see what happens with Isabel and co. But it'd be really interesting to see if there's something here for how to get people to leave power peacefully. Okay, that's it content wise in terms of our democracy watch, in quotes. That's Rwanda, that's Kenya, that's, sorry, Greg is dying with the man flu, I'm sure you can hear him coughing in the background. So that's Rwanda, that's Kenya, that's Angola, And it's things that we continue to watch. So we don't want to do the thing of elections happen, this is what's going on, but we really want to try and give you a bit more insight and context. Now to the last sort of bit of our show, which is actually me saying goodbye. This is going to be my last show as host and sort of co-host of the Daily Maverick show with Greg Nicholson. And I just wanted to say thank you. It's my first job on radio, my first time on air, my first time in part of anything of this sort. And I'm just so deeply appreciative for the opportunity to talk to you guys every week or every second week and be a small part of these really important conversations out of the country and out of the continent. So thank you for the great honor and privilege of allowing me to come on here and attempt to chat to interesting people and share some insights on what's going on. And thank you for the feedback, sometimes positive, sometimes critical, but I think it's always helped us get better. And we've always tried to bring the insights, to contextualize the stories, and to share different perspectives and open minds and contextualize. That's really what we've always tried to do. So it's a deep and massive thank you to everybody listening in, and also just some specific thank yous to the Cliff Central team, Sorina Bloomberg, who's always been so supportive, Gareth, of course, and the team behind the scenes, who you guys don't get to know. So that's Dory, that's Simpiwe, that's Greg Cohen, And who's always on the decks behind the scenes, which is Palesa Mabuye, who's phenomenal and always brings the hip-hop before the show. From the Daily Maverick, Simon Allison, Ranjeni Munusami, Steely Charambolas, for actually giving me the opportunity, and the actual writers who create the content. So Rebecca Davis, Marianne Merton, Marianne Tam, it's a massive thank you. Also, part of our team when we first started for Team Amatiba, who was part of the founding team in a lot of ways, massive thank you to you. And lastly, of course, my co-host Greg Nicholson, for being an awesome support for me behind the scenes and bringing the content together. And of course, on air, bringing the banter, bringing the humor, and bringing his phenomenal journalistic insights. So thank you to everybody tuning in, everybody behind the scenes. We've done probably about 100 shows, and it's a massive thank you. Going forward, you can expect Greg to continue being the producer and the host. The content will always be what it's been, contextual, important, insightful, and we'll continue to try to bring you the best news every week. Thank you. For the last time, this is Kingsley Kipuri, host of the Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. Thank you so much.
The Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. This is CliffCentral.com.